It's 12:06. Welcome back to A Closer Look. I'm Rose Scott alongside Dennis O'Hare. And before we begin this next segment, a word of caution. The subject matter deals with the sexual abuse and trafficking of minors, so it may not be suitable for all listeners.
Well, yesterday, Rose, it was reported that Johns Creek police arrested 15 people as part of a prostitution sting, and it included the arrest of a man who is charged with seeking sex with a minor. And according to the reports, a woman was accused of pimping out her stepdaughter.
You know, Dennis, over the years, police stings like the one in Johns Creek has rescued many minors and adults forced into trafficking. And it's also netted the arrest of traffickers and buyers. But authorities and advocates working to bring awareness about sex trafficking all admit there's a lot more to do. Well, joining us today in our Closer Look studio is Jennifer Swain, Interim Executive Director of YouthSpark. And this organization works to end child sex trafficking through prevention and by empowering teens to recognize the signs among their own. Jennifer, thanks for taking the time.
Thank you for having me.
You know, when you hear about the arrest in Johns Creek and then last week's rescue of two young girls from an apartment in DeKalb County, this problem, although statewide and throughout Atlanta, awareness has been gotten better, but it's still a huge problem. And we're still hearing stories of young children, minors, being forced into trafficking.
Absolutely. And one of the great things about it is that we're really happy to see law enforcement take a more proactive approach to try to seek out young girls and try to seek out women who are needing help and also hold those adults accountable.
When you look at how far the state has come in terms of not just making arrests, but also in the sentencing of these traffickers and the buyers, are organizations like yours happy with what we're seeing so far in terms of the laws that are on the books?
Absolutely. According to Shared Hope's Protected Innocence Challenge, their report card, they grade the laws on the books, and we have a B. We do know that there's room for improvement, but we think every session we take a tiny step in the right direction, and we're really pleased because we have some of the toughest penalties and some of the best prosecutors here in our state.
But sentencing depends on enforcement. Enforcement depends on resources. So are we seeing, not just with state authorities, the GBI, for instance, which has pledged to really put an emphasis on this, but are we seeing, as we saw with Johns Creek, the local authorities moving forward with arrests when they have enough evidence to make them?
Absolutely. We see more local law enforcement agencies joining the MATCH task force, and that is a combination of different law enforcement agencies across the state. So as we see more individual agencies and precincts try to determine ways to be proactive and go after them, we're connecting.
Because that, actually, you mentioned something that goes to the heart of my next question, which is a lot of these operations are not just located in one place. They rely on moving across jurisdictional lines. So is the communication better among the law enforcement folks?
Absolutely. Some of our best partners have begun to see that they really need to communicate more with other officers and that this is a problem that happens over county lines, and so you have to definitely work together.
And they would depend on, especially when it comes to the court process, they would depend on victims willing to tell their stories. That's been a huge problem for law enforcement in the past, partly because oftentimes the victims were initially especially accused of crimes themselves. So where are we with that? Are we making progress in getting the victims to tell their stories and to testify against the traffickers?
I think we have some of the best services here in Georgia, and I think as we have a lot of survivors who've turned into experts, and as more survivors begin to stand out and they don't feel the shame, it empowers other people to say, you know what, this is really not my fault. I can speak out against it and I will be safe.
You know, Jennifer, we've talked before about the internet and how the use of the internet to not only just lure minors and even someone who might think that they're in a quote-unquote legitimate job, but the use of the internet has also been a problem for law enforcement in terms of it, making it hard to seek out someone's on the other end of a laptop or a keyboard actively seeking for sex with a minor. And your organization, and even when it was juvenile, a future not a past, with the Juvenile Justice Fund, your organization, you all even got to sit in on some of these stings Can you, without being too graphic, can you sort of talk about some of the things that you actually heard and people were trying to actually use the internet to order up a child and calling these numbers that they got off the internet?
Absolutely. The internet is now the virtual street, so it makes it so much easier for someone to go on and specifically seek out what type of person they're looking for. What we found, even with the online activity, is that most people don't necessarily seek out a child per se. There's this willful ignorance where they like to dance around the age. But we know that ads that just have sex for sale, they get considerably less amount of clicks than those ads that have keywords such as barely legal, teen, petite. Those types of ads get a lot more clicks. But we recognize that that the internet gives this kind of anonymous feel to it, and people think that you can't find out about it.
And one of the challenges in the past has always been, particularly, and we're just naming the publications that we know of that have been used, that have been named in law enforcement reports, Backpage.com and Craigslist. Has either of those publications become a little bit more responsible in trying to stop people using their publications, their online publications, for seeking sex with a minor? Have they gotten a little bit better about their responsibility?
Well, I think most of those major sites, like you just mentioned, they have a procedure in place, and they do work with the National Center for Missing and Exploited Children to report any suspicious behavior. But we recognize that there's a lot more work that needs to be done. And now it transcends just those online websites to messenger apps. We see now, especially with some of the research studies that we're working on right now, it's apps as well as those internet sites that are used to communicate more and kind of seek out certain requests.
And this is where your organization also works to sort of prevent this from happening by educating teens about warning signs, and then also using teens to sort of look to their peers and be able to recognize that maybe something's not right, or even educate their own peers about that. Tell us a little bit more about Youth Spark and what it's designed to do.
Well, Youth Spark has primarily been on the front lines based at the Fulton County Juvenile Court. And what we recognize is that if we wait to rescue victims, then we're actually taking a little bit too much time. We really want to empower communities to prevent it themselves, to identify girls earlier. And our model, Youth Spark Voices, is a direct service program that's based out of the court where we work with the probation officers to identify girls earlier on that continuum so that we don't wait until something heinous happens or until something really bad has happened to them.
You talk to these girls and they have you've built a relationship with them. Do they talk about how they got caught up or how they were lured at all, and what, you know, not to share all their stories, but what are you hearing?
Well, I think the biggest thing that happens when they come through our program is that they just really don't identify as a victim of anything. Sexual abuse, neglect, those are major things, because one of the things that we recognize is that young girls that come through this program, they really believe that 27-year-old is their boyfriend. They really believe that they're doing what they have to do. So
one of the things that is happening right now as we speak is a drive in the legislature to pass bills that would further tighten the noose, if you will, or the vice on people who are trafficking young women and boys. There is a bill that's passed the House, or excuse me, passed the Senate. It's moved over to the House. There's also a House bill that has a lot of these provisions in it, including a fee on adult entertainment establishments, tougher penalties for traffickers. One of the things that has happened with the Senate bill is the feeling that, okay, a lot of the advocates say it's been changed so that it does not go far enough. But what is it that you want to see the legislature do? And in terms of the bills that are working their way through, are they doing it?
Well, I think Senate Bill 8 and House Bill 244 are bills that have a lot of great things in them. One in particular is that there's a demand-focused bill, and it actually seeks to impose a penalty on actual traffickers, and that includes the John, those men who buy sex as well, and that money goes to victim services. And victim services is a hot topic because we recognize that if any sector participates or indirectly or directly in the perpetuation of this problem, they should want to contribute and be a part of the solution.
Well, there are two questions with that. Let's pick up the adult entertainment establishments first, because we've talked about that on A Closer Look. There's a feeling among some of the, there's an assumption, I guess, in the legislation that, okay, adult entertainment establishments somehow, even though they're aimed at adults, attract people who traffic in children. But is there any proof of that? That's been the argument from the adult clubs is, look, we don't want anything to do with that. Why should we have to pay a fee based on somebody's hunch that there's an indirect association?
Well, one thing is that we do know is there are no hard numbers to show the amounts of underage girls who may be exploited. But USPARC participated in the Provider Project, a research program that we did back in 2012, where we surveyed those working directly with victims, and about 14% of those surveyed noted or identified that they were exploited through the adult entertainment strip clubs. So while we recognize we do need harder numbers and we do need further research, we do know that it is perpetuated throughout that arena.
And Jennifer, when we're talking about data, because I've heard this before from Atlanta Mayor Kasim Reed and others about having exact numbers about where this issue is isolated. Is it an inner city issue? Is it just the city of Atlanta? Is it the suburbs? Well, we have two recent incidents here, one in Johns Creek, one in DeKalb County. So it's still a combination of both. But even with the Shapiro report, which was a report that came out a few years ago, and people still use these numbers. Whenever I read articles and publications about Atlanta or Georgia, we still see the numbers that in any given month, 300 to 400 young girls may be actively trafficked throughout Georgia. Is that data still sufficient, or do we need more concrete numbers? And if so, where's it going to come from, and who's collecting this information? Whose responsibility is it, or should it be? Should it be the state?
Well, this issue, again, is still in this movement is in its infancy. And what we have to recognize is that there's no magical methodology that was ever created to identify this. The one thing that we can say for certain is that trafficking happens in every single culture. It happens in every single community throughout our state. It just looks differently. And you have to recognize that we can't always say where the girls come from, where the exploitation happens, because it moves.
When we come back, we'll continue with our conversation with Jennifer Swain. She is the interim executive director of USPARC, and we're talking about efforts to bring awareness the continued war against child sex trafficking in the state of Georgia. Jennifer, before we went to break, we were talking about numbers and data. Some law enforcement, some authorities, they want numbers to indicate how many minors are being trafficked throughout the state by each jurisdiction. But there was talk of that this information was going to come out of the governor's office. That was, I think, last year, year before. But we still haven't seen anything. So who is collecting this information? If this is what authorities or you know, policymakers want, who's collecting this information?
Well, the GBI did release a report last year that talked about the problem here locally in Georgia. But what we have to rely on now is more credible and real numbers of actual girls. And that those numbers of children under the age of 18, boys and girls being served, is being tracked through Georgia Cares, which is the single point of entry throughout the state of Georgia that connects all victims to services. So we can rely on those numbers. And I think to date, that organization has received over 1,000 referrals of young girls and boys throughout the state of Georgia. And that is a real number.
One of the things then that comes up is, okay, services for these young people. And we talked a moment ago about the legislation that would, through the fees on the adult entertainment establishments or through some of the fines that those convicted of trafficking would have to pay, that money goes to services for the victims. But then the question becomes, okay, where does it go? Services sounds great, but is there anything set up right now that would administer, have some sort of trust over that money and to make sure it goes to services directly, and which services? There will probably be a fight over that.
Well, I think one of the great things about House Bill 244 is that it does have a commission, and that will help to look at those funds and make sure that they are administered appropriately. And the one thing that we have here in Georgia is Georgia Cares, which is the statewide system of care. So that is where the money goes to, and it will actually follow the victim, whether that victim needs residential treatment, whether that victim needs mental health treatment, and that is where it goes.
So the victim would then have to say, okay, here is what has happened to me. In other words, there'd be a paper trail.
Absolutely. Yeah.
Jennifer, a few years ago when we did How to Stop the Candy Shop here with this, and for full disclosure, part of your organization was involved in that, there was a major concern about having enough resources in terms of facilities for these young people to actually go to, because once they're rescued, you can't just necessarily put them on one track as, let's say, with a foster child. There's a whole different track. And what we kept hearing was, we don't have enough beds, we don't have enough facilities. When you talk about that large number, which you just mentioned, children that need services, and we're hearing there are less than maybe 200 beds, 200 spaces for them, that's a problem.
Absolutely. We definitely need more resources, and we need different types of resources. And I think that that's one of the things that we're working together here in Georgia to find out. Where are the gaps in the services? How can we fill those things in? But GBI Director Vernon Keenan really just spoke and said, as fast as his officers and law enforcement are working together to identify them, we need more beds.
So let's go through this. A victim is rescued. You can't put that, and it's a minor, you can't put them in jail. What's the next step? What's the process?
Well, really, that child, again, should be identified as a trafficking victim. And out of the 2008 legislature, this is a form of child abuse that needs to be reported. So that child should definitely be referred to the Department of Family and Children Services. They need to be able to react and have a protocol. And
DFACS has their own issues. DFACS has their own issues as well, just in general, and making sure children are safe. This adds another layer of an issue for them.
Absolutely. I think that as advocates, we have to do a better job of trying to help educate the entire system and make sure that they understand of what it means and what to do.
Is there a state that sort of has it right? I don't want to say gets it right, but is there a state that you can talk about that has sort of a template for what you all would like to see here in terms of victim resources from when a child is rescued or a minor is rescued?
I really wish there was. I think that
really?
Every state is different. And while one state may have residential care, or one state may have tougher laws, or one state may have different types of services, I think it varies. And there's not one state that has every single thing right. There are a few states through the report card that have A's, but that's based on laws, not services. So I think that Georgia is still leading the nation in the response. And again, what I really want to focus on is, how can we empower communities to prevent this from ever happening as much as rescuing them?
Well, on that point, is the recent arrest in Johns Creek and is the recent bust in DeKalb County a sign that we're really making substantial progress in this long war? Or is it that, okay, these arrests are happening periodically and we're hearing more about them because of the attention that's been focused on the issue, and that we're not really making any more of a dent than we were before?
I really believe that we're making a bigger dent. I think with the amount of law enforcement and the amount of training that happens through the GBI, that happened through Attorney General Sam Olin's office, more officers are now getting the signs on how to identify it. And then also, what are the right questions to ask? So I think with that, and the number of community-based trainings, the school system that is now reaching out, wanting to educate the teachers on how to identify signs and how to report it, I think we're making definite strides, but we have a long way to go.
Because it's hard, of course, since we don't know how extensive, in terms of numbers, the problem is. When you start getting numbers on arrests, it's hard to know whether you're really making a big dent in the overall problem.
Absolutely. But I think if you identify two children today, then that is success.
Jennifer, when we talk about focusing on the demand side, we've talked about the victims. When we talk about the demand side and we talked about the internet, what are still some of the challenges in decreasing the demand here? You can't control people's habits, obviously, but maybe change mindsets, what people should be looking to be able to identify people in their own community. This is not an inner city problem. So where do you begin to come up with a plan to decrease the demand?
I think you have to work twofold. You have to empower law enforcement, number one, on how to get those people who, even when they know that they may be purchasing a minor, how to make sure that we hold them accountable and don't give them a slap on the wrist and treat them just as we would a pimp. We have to begin to treat the buyer. But I think we have to take a step ahead, and we have to start looking at young boys right now. And that's one of the things that we're trying to do with our youth empowered education, is create bold and unique ways, not sexually overt, but very clear, unique ways to speak to young men so that they understand what their role is in this problem. Because it is really our hope that we can keep young girls and young boys from becoming victims. But if we start working with 12-year-olds right now and make sure that they understand and they're aware of this problem, then when they become 21, they are less likely to become buyers.
Because you're talking about local community services, which means local governments to some extent. I mean, obviously, you've got private sector initiatives that are going on, nonprofit efforts, you know, like your own. But are local governments equipped, because they have the law enforcement power, to provide those services right now when they're struggling with their own budgets?
They may not. And again, this is one problem that law enforcement and government, they cannot fix on their own. We as a community have to begin to say, okay, it starts in my house. It starts with my church. It starts with my child. Because this can't just be fixed by a legal approach only. So we have to begin to embed what it means to be preventative, and what it means to decrease demand. And that has to happen at very, very small level with individuals.
Jennifer, finally, before we wrap up, in talking about who these victims are, not necessarily black, not necessarily white, there's a perception that these are either runaway kids or bad kids, or they wanted to do it. How is your group working to also dispel that perception from people that think the kids that are involved, it's through their own fault?
I think at its core, we have to recognize that the child or the adolescent brain is not developed to make decisions. We know that by the laws that we have on the books, where you cannot drive until a certain age, you cannot drink until a certain age. So we have to recognize that at a young age, they are the most vulnerable. But it happens in every single community, and any child can be vulnerable. We want to empower parents to get involved with social media. We want to empower schools. Everybody needs to take the approach. It just can't be one single effort.
And Rose hit on something that's really important. It's the diversity of the victims that really would pose a challenge to any social service effort to help them, because the needs of a young person who maybe has run away from home here in Georgia and might have a parent looking for them is going to be a whole lot different. Those needs are going to be way different from somebody who is brought in from another country and trafficked and has no one here. So how does a service agency try to address all those different needs of all those different victims?
And the beauty of that is that there are lots of different agencies. Again, all services are coordinated through Georgia Cares, but they may not go to one single place. We have those agencies on the ground that work with kids coming through the juvenile court, such as YouthSpark. We have agencies on the ground that works with foreign-born victims. So there are lots of different groups. And again, there's a seat at the table for everybody. So we're really glad that we have a diverse amount of services.
Jennifer Swain is the Interim Executive Director of YouthSpark. Jennifer, thanks for coming in and taking the time. We appreciate it.
Thank you so much for having me.